So let me be clear. And I just want everybody to be clear about this. Let me be clear.
People, let the man be clear.
And let me be clear, it's In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, inflicting on you once again that dangerous brew of news and a cappella. There's an Andy Bernard in me dying to get out, I'm sorry, but it has been a few weeks. Anyway, 8 months in, and I think Obama needs a good catchphrase. It's about time. Like, you know, wouldn't be prudent, or feel your pain, or what's a good Bush one? Evildoers, or on the hunt. I always liked on the hunt. Obama made a pretty good case on Wednesday night, that big healthcare press conference, as you heard there, for let me be clear. But that one's not a lot of fun, I don't think. It could be fun. I was just imagining if he could bring, you know, like Patrick Stewart, Jean-Luc Picard along with him to every press conference, kind of get the attention of everybody in the room, you know, let me be clear. But that's just me and my bad Patrick Stewart impression. And if this seems like kind of an unfocused opening, it's because, well, partly because this has been one of those kind of odd, unfocused weeks in the news. I mean, you know, Sandin and me, we were totally focused. This week's news has been kind of a little of this, a little of that, you know, some holdover stories from a couple of weeks ago, more Michael Jackson, blah, blah. No, you know, specific big events or themes that really held the world transfixed. The healthcare debate, maybe, but that's been going on for months. And we'll dabble in healthcare reform a little bit today, but mostly we're going to use the podcast to look into some questions, lingering questions that we've had and that our listeners have asked us to look into, such as, what's the deal with organic wine? That was a listener question. And another one, are we scared enough of terrorism these days? That was one of mine. But we're going to start with another question that I jotted on my cubicle whiteboard a little while ago. Sandin and I have been talking about it. And this question even comes with its own theme song. What's going on with Vice President Joe Biden?
Hey, Joe, where'd you go? Hey, Biden, where are you hiding? 1 minute he's there, feel a burst of hot air, and then, hey, where's Joe?
Capturing the conventional wisdom there anyway, our little Joe Biden theme song. This week, as a matter of fact, it was not terribly hard to find the Vice President of the United States. He has been in Georgia and the Ukraine, reassuring them, essentially, after President Obama's recent trip to try to make nice with Russia. Biden laying down a little bit of tough love for the Ukraine, telling them to get their act together. But for the most part, a trip of reassuring a couple of our smaller allies in the region. But most weeks, for most of us casual observers of the news, Joe Biden is really under the radar. Except, of course, when he's overexposed for one of his trademark bloopers, which seem to happen on just about a weekly basis. Surely there is more than meets the untrained eye, we figured. So we found somebody who lives and breathes, believe it or not, Joe Biden. Her name is Jen Stachowski, and she started out covering him for a site called vicepresidents.com, and she now writes the Biden Examiner blog. She also writes for the political site Dunkelfint. And Jen, thank you very much for talking with In the Loop.
No problem.
So I put a little post out on Twitter earlier this morning that I was going to do this interview, and here's how one of our listeners, Robert, describes Joe Biden. He said, the VP job is hiding in an undisclosed location, then coming out to spout crazy talk to make the president look level-headed. Joe Biden, FTW, which is for the win, apparently. I had to look that one up. How close does that come to describing the reality of what Vice President Joe Biden is?
Well, it's a little close, but not quite, because Joe Biden has already disclosed the location of the undisclosed location by accident. He said that a young naval officer gave him a tour of the residence and showed him the hideaway, which is behind a massive steel door secured by an elaborate lock with a narrow connecting hallway lined with shelves.
This is the actual undisclosed location that a vice president might use, or maybe
it
Cheney
really
did use. Oh, I see. I see. I had missed that. And that's the thing, right? Even Joe Biden, he's just kind of, he's figuratively at an undisclosed location because we just are not hearing very much about him. But is there a lot that we're missing?
Oh, yes. Lately, he's been traveling to talk about clean energy in Toledo, Ohio. He's also been in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was talking about the middle-class jobs there. He went to speak to the gay and lesbian community at the LGBT Leadership Council fundraiser. He definitely has a tough job because he has to go around and talk to all these different groups of people and let them know that their issues are his issues. Like you may have heard, he went to talk about peanuts. Somebody was poisoned by peanuts, and Joe Biden wanted to say, oh, food safety is our number one issue. But you have to wonder, how many number one issues can they possibly have?
I hope food safety is not their number one issue. It's an important issue, but there are some other big ones.
Yeah.
What's the role right now that you think he's playing for the Obama administration as he's hopping from town to town?
Well, he has a couple different roles. This one here, I think he's just completely backing up what Obama's saying. But there are times that he projects the opposite of what Barack Obama's trying to say. And in that case, they're sort of an odd couple. Like, Biden will come out and he'll say, oh, yeah, we were thinking about this second stimulus. But if the reaction is particularly bad, then Obama can come in and say, oh, just kidding, guys. He didn't really mean that. That's not what Joe was really trying to say.
Now, you wrote about that on your blog the other day. It seems like a typical, you know, Biden gaffe. But you think there might have been something strategic to that?
Definitely. I think Joe Biden, as the number two, can get away with saying things that Barack Obama may not be able to say or may not be comfortable saying. If it works out well, Obama will come in and say that they're doing fine. If it doesn't go over well, then Obama's got to do a little bit of damage control.
Was there anything strategic going on when he said he wouldn't let his family go on a plane or a train because they might catch swine flu?
Oh, no. I think that was just classic, like, Joe Biden diarrhea of the mouth.
That was just his big screw-up.
He's definitely had a few of those. Like, when he was in New Jersey talking about how Amtrak is getting all this money from the stimulus, he said, look, this new tunnel, it's designed to provide for automobile traffic. When, of course, Amtrak is rail. So people started to wonder, you know, does he really know what he's talking about with this economy thing?
Well, what do you think happened there? You follow him day to day. Was he just too much information and get confused?
Yeah, he's kind of spreading himself too thin with this stimulus thing. I mean, he has this enormous task of having to track down all the projects that are going on, keep track of how every stimulus dollar is spent, and make sure that things aren't misspent. There is a really good article in Time magazine by Michael Shearer. And he was talking about projects that Joe Biden scrapped that people are trying to get money for. For instance, they wanted to spend $7 million for the Interior Department aircraft to study bird migration, $10,000 for a refrigerator to house fish sperm in South Dakota.
So he's having to take the red pen to some of these projects that people are proposing for their stimulus money and be the bad guy.
Absolutely. And so he's looking for, you know, all these pet projects like Barbara Boxer's trying to get a skate park in Long Beach. And Joe says, well, we want infrastructure. We want lots of jobs being created. Because they're catching a lot of flack for that right now, especially in places like Ohio, where it's 10.8% joblessness and their approval rating has already dipped below 50%.
So, Jen, on the scale of vice presidents, from, say, Dan Quayle level irrelevance to Dick Cheney behind-the-scenes mastermindedness, what kind of vice president do you think Joe Biden is turning out to be?
But I think a lot of Joe Biden's role kind of comes all the way back from Walter Mondale, who was a very trusted vice president, and he was actively involved in every decision that was made. It's almost in a way like we have two presidents, but because there's so much to do, they just kind of split up the tasks.
Two presidents. You don't think that's hyperbole to say it's almost like we have two presidents?
No, I don't. I was very shocked to hear Joe Biden say that he's going to take it personally responsibly, you know, the success or the failure of the stimulus spending. That's a pretty lofty statement.
Well, yeah, but couldn't that just be Joe Biden talking like Joe Biden does?
I suppose. He said in Time magazine, like, I'm the guy in charge of this deal, so if it doesn't work, it's me.
Well, Jen Stachowski, talking with me from Buffalo, New York. Thanks very much for spending some time within the loop.
No problem. Thanks.
Jen writes her Biden blog for Examiner.com, and she also writes for Donkelfant.com. Of course, Joe Biden and his trip to the caucuses could hardly compete with President Obama and the healthcare reform debate that consumed so much of the news this week. That's all budgets and bureaucracies and committee hearings, a perfectly clunky topic to try to gin up some in-the-loop listener poetry. And I threw out a few haiku of my own on our Facebook page just to get people started, get the ball rolling. Here's one of those. Finance committee hangs back while others argue. Get in there, damn it. 575, check it out. A few brave folks answered the call. First up, Robert Fisher, our buddy Robert from Durham, North Carolina, with a healthcare haiku of his own.
Is it life and death? Seems more like politics. One shot to get it right.
Thank you, Robert. Also rolling in on Facebook, a short rhyming verse from Scott Woldrich, who lives here in the Twin Cities, I believe.
I think that we shall never see healthcare reform where all agree. Indeed, unless partisan boundaries fall, we may not see reform at all.
Thank you, Scott. Taking a cue from Joyce Kilmer there and melding it to a thoroughly modern political cynicism. Thanks to both those guys, Robert and Scott, for recording those at home at our behest and sending them to us. Now, a little bit longer entry from one of our regular news poets on the show, Craig Kenworthy, out in Bozeman, Montana, who has named this particular poem, "Should I Just Google My Symptoms?"
President Obama wants health care reform right now. Hurrying a bit, like a middle-aged man who knows his wife will veto the new car if she takes a look at the sticker before they go for a spin. With the wife played by some Democrats in Congress and the wife's nosy friend played by the Republicans, you going to let him spend how much? Hell, the old car is fine. Just needs some new tires and fewer safety features. And the public saying, helping out the uninsured sounds cool, as long as someone else pays for it. How about technology to lower those costs? A few new iPhone apps to touch patients online? We'll just have to figure out a virtual way to handle the other part of, please turn your head and cough. Maybe the real question is not whether we can afford healthcare reform at all, but whether we can afford healthcare for all, formed the way it is now for some of us.
CraigKenworthy.com is where you can learn a little more about our friend Craig out in Montana. We always want news poems from you, and you don't have to wait for us to throw a topic out, of course. You can hit us with anything that you spot in the news. And let me just say, ladies, where you at? The men kind of loving the news poetry thing. Women, not so much so far, but we'd love to get some women's voices on the air. So try us. Find that link to that form on the right-hand side of our main webpage at intheloopshow.net. Although this particular call-out I put on the Facebook page, as a matter of fact, at loopfacebook.net. So I guess just never know. We like to try different places, keep you hopping. Looking for a meme from the news this week for some music. I didn't have to look any further than the health care reform debate. All I needed was a good tune, and I should have known that if I put my head together with Sandin, the result might have something to do with comic books. So here you go.
Public plan, Dems will slip it in if they can. Lost your job? Don't despair. Join the old folks in Medicare. Look out, here comes the public plan. What's it cost? That's the hitch. Tax the corporate world, soak the rich. On the right, nothing new. Smell a possible Waterloo. Come on, let's get the public plan. No surprise, we've seen the debate. Go to heck, is there compromise between Michael Moore?
Permission to enter!
And Glenn Beck!
Get off my phone!
Ow! Public plan, maybe that plus some Raisin Bran makes for one catchy song. Does it actually fix what's wrong? Not sure, here comes the public plan. Yeah, we hate the public plan. Oh, we all love the public plan. It's all on the public plan.
There you have it, short and sweet this week. Kind of a little bluegrass, klezmer, klezgrass take on the Spider-Man theme, except about the public option aspect of the healthcare reform debate. That little tune, no doubt, making the rounds and shaping the discourse on Capitol Hill as we speak. As usual, there is a video of the recording of that tune on our Facebook page and on our website, intheloopshow.net. And while you're at the website, right there on the main page, scroll down just a bit. You'll see a little area where you can type in anything that you want us to check into, any questions you have or things you think we should learn about. It's called a Scribbit. And we have a little Scribbit song. It goes like this.
Scribbit.
It's a very little Scribbit song. But when you hear it, that means that our producer, Sandin Totten, is here with me in the studio. Sandin, how does it make you feel to hear the Scribbit tune?
Just a little proud every time.
Well, I know you've been digging into the Scribbit suggestions. We've been sort of churning through them here, and we get a couple new ones every now and then, but we're beginning to whittle them down. What are we going to focus on today?
Well, today I found another theme that was developing, mostly about farming. So I thought I would stick to farming, but we're going to go like to two totally opposite ends of farming here.
Farming doesn't sound very exciting.
Well, wait till you get into it. Okay, so we're going to start, you know, right, with one side of the spectrum, you know, sort of hippy-dippy, organic, feel-good farming from California.
Woo.
But by the end of it, we're going to like mad science farming that will just blow your mind and possibly change the world as we know it.
What about just running a combine through the field and getting in the corn.
No, not interested.
Okay. Maybe next time. All right. Hippy dippy farming is up first. What was the question that a listener left for us on the Scribbit?
Okay. Well, someone was asking about organic wine.
Organic wine.
Organic wine. It's, okay. Organic is a big buzzword right now, and there's all these organic wines hitting the shelves. But what makes it organic? Is it about the process? Is it about not using pesticides? Huh. Well, the answer is...
It's both, actually.
And who's that dude who just magically appears to answer our question?
That is Don Berdahl, and this is like his favorite subject. His email is even like wine guy at like whatever Comcast or something.
Mm-hmm. So's mine, but with an H.
he works for this vineyard that makes Our Daily Red and Orleans Hill, which are two of the well-known organic wines. And he says the main difference is what you spray on the vineyards.
One of the major differences would be the amount of liquid sulfur dioxide that is sprayed onto the vineyards. You are allowed to spray that one time in organic farming up until April or veraison of the grapes when the buds start to break.
So what do you guys do when you can't spray that, but you still got to worry about mold and bugs and gross stuff all over your grapes?
Really what it amounts to is you have to be a little bit more labor intensive. You know, you keep the weeds out from underneath. You can spray milk solids on top of the vineyards. It definitely inhibits bugs.
Wait. So we're talking about spraying milk onto grapevines to help stay bug-free?
Yeah, the bugs don't like it. They don't like digesting it. They don't like being around it. And so it's a good deterrent.
Wow. Now, is the milk you use also organic? That would be the question.
Absolutely.
So, Sandon, that's something you and grape bugs have in common. You don't like milk.
Yeah, they'd keep me away from their grapes, too, if they spray milk all over it. So smart plan, because otherwise I was going to be right over there eating them anytime now.
So is that the whole deal with organic wine?
Well, okay, so the other big thing, and this might gross you out, is there's no additives in organic wine. And conventional wines, especially the kind that's like under $10, the kind I can afford and probably you can afford, have stuff like copper
True.
Sulfate, charged plastic, bentonite, diaminium phosphate. Basically, if you're going to do it organic style, you got to keep it raw. You can't put any of that stuff in there. Berdahl said that the main point is to make it taste like every other wine. You just can't use the tricks that other wines use to make it taste good when the grapes suck, basically.
Hmm. Have you tried organic wine?
Oh, yeah. I've tried a few times. Under $10, of course, cheap kinds. It's not bad.
Can you get organic wine for under $10?
Yeah. The whole thing about the brand that Don started with his partners, that they wanted to make cheap organic wine, so all their wines are about $10.
Oh, that I did not know. You could get organic wine for the price a stingy guy like me usually pays for a normal bottle of wine. All right, so farming is our theme, and you have a second farming-related query from one of our listeners on the Scribbit. What was that?
So if Don Berdahl and his team are trying to keep things as natural as possible, these next folks, they are trying to go as way off the deep end as they can with farming. The question that inspired this was someone said, look into transgenic animals in Minnesota.
Yeah, starting with figuring out what that means.
Right. Well, the first thing I did was I Googled it. Once I found out what it was, I called up Professor Michael White. He's a professor of animal science at the University of Minnesota.
A transgenic animal is an animal that has had a foreign gene introduced into its genome.
It's like a mashup, a hybrid animal?
Yes, definitely. And the gene can come from anywhere, you know, from a bacteria or from a plant or from another animal or another species.
So we're not talking like about like bear cougars here or like eagle lions or something?
No, we're not. Not chimeras. But there's actually a number that have had genes for specific drugs introduced into the mammary gland so that certain sheep will produce blood clotting factors, human blood clotting factors in their milk that can be purified out and used as a drug.
Drug milk. It sounds about as tasty as diaminium phosphate. What's the point of that?
Well, if you make like a, you know, human insulin or protein or something in a lab, it's kind of artificial, and so your body's going to reject it. But if you actually splice human genes into, you know, a goat or a sheep or something like that, they're going to start producing, you know, human proteins and human insulin on their own, like a little drug factory. And you just take that out through their milk or whatever, and, you know, you got like a drug your body's going to accept really easily.
So are there ethical problems with this kind of Franken sheep farming?
Well, you'd think. I asked Professor Michael White the same question. I got to ask, what does PETA think about all this?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that that's an interesting debate. To bring it even more to the debate, there are animals that are being made transgenic, so they can be used as organ donors for humans.
Wow. So that opens up a whole other can of ethical worms.
Yes, it is. So
whether or not we should be growing our organs in living things.
Exactly.
So could this go wrong in any way? I mean, you know, there's all these sci-fi movies, you know, where like super smart lab rats attack, or, you know, we could get zombie goats or something. But
right.
I mean, that's a little far-fetched, but...
Well, here's the issue. It's called zoonotic diseases, and we're dealing with one right now called the swine flu. It's a disease that can cross species. So let's say that there's a certain kind of a pig sickness that doesn't affect humans at all, but I have a pig heart, and I come in contact with pigs that had this disease. It will attack my heart. And so zoonotic diseases become a real big problem.
So with transgenic animals, we may end up curing and fixing a whole bunch of problems, but we might create a whole other set of problems we have to now deal with.
Yep, that's the truth with almost any new technology.
Now, the listener who submitted this question on our website specifically said, look into transgenic animals in Minnesota, and you found this guy in Minnesota. Is Minnesota particularly significant in this field?
Well, yeah. Minnesota is the place where they're making these pig organs right now. You know, the pig hearts, pig livers, or whatever they're going to take from pigs and put in us one day.
Put it on the state seal.
Yeah. Michael White himself is working on making, like, super muscular cows, I think he described them.
Yeah.
You knock out, like, one gene, and these cows turn into, like, Hulk cows with extra, you know, beefy legs and butts, and perfect for, you know, a state that likes a lot of burgers.
But not medical in any way.
I don't think
perhaps
so.
Perhaps the opposite of medical. More beef in our diet.
Right. You can drink it with the organic wine, and you know, I'm sure you'll be having a good day at least.
Yeah. They kind of cancel each other out philosophically, I would think. And I think that's it for your farming update today. Very interesting. What's another Scribd question that's been on your mind that you're working on for next time you appear?
Okay, so this one has plagued me because I ask it all the time. Someone just mysteriously left, robots. Our future or our end?
Right up your alley.
I tried to dismiss it, but you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff actually coming out about the ethics of robots and you know, some new robotic designs and stuff. So it's a question we're going to dig in for the next Scribdcast.
And what a horrible challenge for you to have to think about robots. My goodness, you just hate that topic, don't you? All right, Sandin Totten, our producer, coming by with the Scribdcast. Thanks, Sandin.
Thank you, Jeff.
Scribd.
Okay, and help us keep that Scribd stocked. If you've got a thought of something you'd like Sandin to maybe look into, head to our website and put your suggestion in the box. It's just that simple. And now, terrorism. Yeah, I don't know any more graceful segue into it. Unfortunately, kind of a difficult topic, but a guest that we've been meaning to get back to for a while, and so I'm glad to have a chance to catch up with him. There's hardly a day when it's not relevant to talk about global terrorism, but this past week gave us plenty of good reasons. These hotel suicide bombs in Jakarta, the one guy captured from those Mumbai attacks decided to plead guilty now, and he's talking all about the operation. Had a bunch of new deaths that have made this the deadliest month ever in Afghanistan for U.S. and British soldiers. We've been meaning for a while to talk again with Sajan Gohel. He is the Director for International Security at the Asia-Pacific Foundation in London. Just a good guy to talk to when you need a little perspective, somebody who lives their life immersed in some of the more difficult news happening around the globe. Sajan, thanks very much for talking again with In the Loop.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you.
Now, last Friday we had the hotel bombings in Jakarta, but nobody has really nailed a Western target in a while. I mean, nothing certainly on the scale of 9/11 or the London train bombings. Those were years ago. Are we actually safer, do you believe?
Well, bear in mind, it's not from a want of trying. Terrorist groups have attempted to carry out plots in the West, particularly in the UK, but some have been disrupted by the authorities, others simply failed. So Al-Qaeda and its affiliates still want to try and target the West, but if they can't do it in the West specifically, the easier opportunity is to try and carry out attacks at Western targets abroad. So we've seen hotels being primary targets for terrorism.
Is the global terror threat, you think, substantially different today than it was 8 years ago on 9/11?
It is to some extent. I think what's worrying in many ways is that you're seeing autonomous, independent groups that have simply looked at the audio messages and the video messages by bin Laden and al-Zawahiri and are inspired by those. They do their own training, their own preparation. They are able to assemble explosive devices, and they attempt to carry out attacks from that limited experience that they actually have. So increasingly, we're seeing the self-radicalized terrorists. And in many ways, that's a bigger problem, because that doesn't necessarily leave a huge trail for counterterrorism agencies to follow.
And what's their motivation? Is it the same as, bin Laden's, essentially, hatred for the U.S.?
It is very ideological. There is this powerful doctrine Al-Qaeda has articulated, just like we saw with the videos of two of the London bombers with the July 7th attacks 2005. The way they spoke showed that they had no loyalty or bearing to the country they were brought up in, despite the fact they spoke in local accents. Their loyalty was to an ideology and a doctrine. And in many ways, that's almost more dangerous because of the fact that it's that message that keeps going unchallenged. No one has been able to delegitimize Al-Qaeda's message effectively enough that it's harmed their propaganda.
How are we failing to get at the message?
Well, I would say that the West can only do so much, because what bin Laden has done very skillfully over the last 8 years is to cite the Quran. The key is to have independent scholars, those that are versed in the Quran, within the Islamic world that can challenge the lies and the half-truths that Al-Qaeda articulates. If you weaken the message, then you weaken the messenger.
As much as you know about these networks, do you think that those of us in the West who are not so steeped in it day to day carry around with us a sufficient amount of fear?
Unfortunately, perhaps governments in the West have not articulated enough the threat of terrorism. I understand the skepticism. There are people in the UK, so a lot of them are my friends, who don't necessarily believe that the threat is as real as the government is portraying, and that is because they don't know enough about the plots that fail.
Right. You're blowing my mind a little bit with all your references to how many failed attacks there have been. I guess I had no idea.
Well, this is the point. I'll give you a brief example that was extremely disturbing.
Please.
There was
an
individual called Nikki Riley, who was in his 20s, but he had Asperger's syndrome, so he had the mental age of 12. He'd been recruited online by two individuals that have yet to be identified. He was trained to create an explosive device packed with nails. He went to a cafe in Western England, where he assembled the device in the toilet. The device actually exploded in his face. It didn't kill him. It didn't kill anybody in the cafe itself. But the point is that you had an individual with the mental capacity of a 12-year-old being trained online to carry out an attack. Governments need to be able to talk to the public more effectively to say this plot took place, and that way there is a better education of the public, who perhaps then will not be so skeptical.
Well, the next step then, of course, is what anyone individually can do about it. I mean, you could walk around every day with a bulletproof vest on.
In many ways, there is little that can be effectively done. But the public can also serve as a useful tool of providing information if they think individuals are perhaps rearing towards a radical side. There was a recent case in the UK where an individual was plotting and planning attacks, and it was actually the local Muslim community that alerted the authorities to what he was potentially planning to do. But in terms of protecting yourselves, that is very difficult.
So, Sajjan, are you able to leave the office and go home at night or go out to the pub and forget about all this stuff?
It took some time to get used to it, but yes, I think sometimes...
Can you get a night's sleep?
Yes. I think it's something that I do get depressed by at times. I think my social life has taken a hit substantially.
All right. Well, it's evening where you are, so head on out and have a good time and think of us. And thank you very much for stopping by to keep us well informed.
No, it's my pleasure. It's always good to talk to you.
Little easygoing music from the Smarts here to help us relax after that conversation. Sajjan Gohel is the Director for International Security at the Asia Pacific Foundation, and he was talking to me direct from his office in London. Had a little something funny going on technically with that interview, which made me sound a little like I'm in a tunnel or something like that, but who cares? I don't sound like that now. In the Loop is produced by Sandin Totten and me. And you know, before we go, after that kind of a downer of a conversation, thought it might be just a nice time to take a moment and reprise a tune from last fall about a phenomenon that I think now is long gone, but the memories and the warm, fuzzy feelings remain. Do you remember that webcam that was trained on a bunch of Shiba Inu puppies? And for a short while, it was all that the globe could talk about. Everybody spent days at their work focused on these cute little puppies, enjoying that kind of tunnel vision that can only come from forgetting about the outside world and focusing on something cute on the internet. Well, I had a friend of mine, Bridget Murphy, she works in marketing here, as a matter of fact, come on up and do a little singing for me on our little ode to the puppy cam. And if this doesn't make you feel better, well, then you have a hard, cold, bitter heart, my friend. But we're still glad to have you listening to the podcast. Thanks for being here. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I will talk to you next time.
What did Shiba Inus? Sticks them in a box. Rolling all around and playing tug of war with socks. The puppy cam can.
The puppy cam can.
The puppy cam can, because hey, all you do is click and there are puppies on your screen. What shows up in your email, forward it to you. Distracts you at the office from the work that you should do. The puppy cam can.
The puppy cam can.
The puppy cam can, and when your boss is not around, you can watch it all day. Puppies flop around, wrestling on the ground, delighting everyone who sees them. Don't you wish that you could squeeze them? You can click them, pause, and freeze them. They're just so cute. What can lift your spirits? Put a smile on your face. Forget about the misery that is the human race. The puppy cam can.
The puppy cam can.
The puppy cam can, because hey, all you do is click and there are puppies on your screen. Yawning puppies on your screen. Yipping puppies on your screen. Fuzzy puppies on your screen.